What a pleasure to be home. I don't know if everyone knows about Donna Lynn's family. Her niece was killed very suddenly, and so she's gone up to be with them. So keep her close by. We've been planning Sesshin. Wendy has been planning Sesshin like a house afire. And it's coming together very nicely. So I'm glad you all are going to be a part of it. I think most of you are going to. I hope you can come, all of you, to the Shuso ceremony, because that's really special. In the meantime, we're about halfway through the precepts. I don't know what you did last Tuesday. I've forgotten how that was. That was you, wasn't it?
The two-minute discussion.
Ah, that's right.
Very interesting.
On the what?
The empathy,
empathy standard?
There are a lot of people here. That's what I remember.
It's a full house.
That's great.
And then the week before, Donna Lynn that gave her impressions of what is a sangha.
Good idea.
Very expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. Super.
I'll tell you now. I can't hear you. I talked about how President Obama said a few times that judges should have empathy.
Mm-hmm.
I
see. Yes, and that's what some of the senators didn't like. They thought that was suspicious.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Very good Buddhist subject. Well, I've been in a household for the last few days of lots of animals. They're very empathetic toward animals and animal rights. So they have two huge dogs. It's a small house, but very large dogs that drape themselves on the sofa. And a very snooty cat that seems to own the whole place. A whole bunch of chimney swifts have set up home in the chimney. You can't see them, but every 10 or 15 minutes there's this sudden outcry. These birds are just chattering away like mad. And then it simmers down. I think the parents are coming to feed them. So it's this cacophony going on of in the house. And then outside, they put out corn for the deer. And the deer, at this point, the males have these beautiful, soft, thick horns before they get hard and sharp. They have these round, soft ones. And they come stalking in first and eat the corn. And if there's any left, the ladies come and eat up the rest of it. And there are a whole bunch of feral cats. So they're also feeding the feral cats and slowly catching them and getting them spayed. So I just marveled about how they were making all these connections. They actually took a baby feral cat whose mother wouldn't take care of it, about this big, really tiny little kitten, and were feeding it every 2 hours. My granddaughter was 7 years old, was feeding with a little tiny bottle. She'd get up in the middle of the night and feed it with this little bottle. It was amazing. So So I thought, these people aren't Buddhists, but they sure do act like it. And maybe Sotomayor is like that too. There are a lot of us who don't have to be an ist or an ism to live a life of care and kindness. So we left off, I do believe, with the sixth precept, the no dwelling on past mistakes or no dwelling on others' faults. And I wonder how that went for you, if you remembered it. It's about speech, kind speech, especially, not speaking of others' faults. We have to notice them, but we don't always have to say something about it.
We discussed that one.
Did we discuss that one?
I believe so. And I think that...
So the next one is no praising self while abusing others.
I mean, yeah, one.
Good. Okay. Well, I know I talked about it briefly at the end of the last meeting, but I'm not sure I talked about the whole thing. Anyway, the essence of that one is being in the present. You know, if we're always harking back to the past and making a big deal about what happened, we're missing what's actually happening right now. So it isn't that we don't notice, it's that we don't, Bodhidharma says, expound upon error. It's very tempting to do that. Very tempting. So the seventh one is no praising self while abusing others, or no praise or blame. And this brings up the question that is essential to all the precepts: what is the self and what is the other? We make that distinction so carefully. And then how do we measure the worth of ourself as against an other? And of course, we're always being measured. We grew up being measured. You know, they measured our length and weight when we were born, wrote it all down. They gave us grades in kindergarten and first grade even. We pass or fail. We're good or we're bad. It gets to be a habitual state of mind, measuring ourself and measuring ourself against others. They say, actually, it's the last holdout of the ego. It's really, really hard not to do. It's based on anxiety. Am I doing okay? I met someone in Boulder whose way of growing up was that she never knew if she was doing the right thing, except that they weren't hitting her. So there was always this intense anxiety, and if she was being hit, then she knew she'd made a mistake of some kind. She didn't quite know a lot of times what it was. That's an extreme example, but I think we all go through a lot of life trying to figure out what the right way is and letting the way things happen to us inform us as best they can. It seems like we're all in separation. We're all discrete individuals, and yet I always say, if we look around and really attend to what our life is happening, we're constantly being supported by others, mostly strangers, people we'll never even know. It's again another situation where we try to cover up our sense of our fragility, our weakness, by being superior, praising self and blaming others puts us in a high seat. But the truth is, there is no high seat ever. We're all really on the same plane. Always have been, always will be. So Dogen says, all beings are Buddha nature. But sometimes you'll meet a very large Buddha. He said, don't be intimidated. Don't let a large Buddha intimidate you. And he said, sometimes you'll meet a little tiny Buddha. And he said, don't feel superior to that little tiny Buddha. Buddha is Buddha. So there's no need to feel as anxious as often we do. So whether it's praising others and abusing ourselves, or praising ourselves and abusing others, it's the same thing. It's the same self. Or no self and no others. And that means completely accepting and being satisfied with what happens, without judging. Bodhidharma said, in the midst of equality, no dwelling on I and you. He doesn't say throw away I and you. We can't do that. We have to be someone. And we know each other through each other. We know our life through each other. That's how, what self is. Self is you and you and you and I. It's a marvelous thing if we don't get caught by it, if we don't start to project, if we don't get scared. What do you think? Jane?
I'm wondering if the body is, well, it's a silly way to put it, but if the body is the most important, because I'm going to follow this kind of thought, and I know we don't want to say which is more important. Okay.
Well, carry on.
Okay. Because it seems that the way we get into trouble is all of our thinking or our feeling about this or that. And I was thinking also about how, the praising of self or the praising of others, it's even a habitual body state, is my experience of it. You know, when I start going off on some tangent one way or the other, it's usually some habitual response to something that's happening out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the body experienced something that's totally short-circuiting. My mind's kind of catching up with my body and saying, oh yeah, that's another thing, giving reasons for why my body is experiencing. So, it seems that while we're encouraged to embrace how the body, as Fireside Theater puts it, falls apart like rotten fruit, at the same time, it seems that it's quite a humbling and dependable
truth. Yeah.
The mind goes everywhere, but the body stays.
Yeah.
That's where you are.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if it's correct to think of it that way.
Absolutely. We start and end with the body. And this is positing a relative and an absolute as we talk about it. There's the relative side, the measuring side, and the absolute side, the Bodhidharma side, that there is no separation between self and other. There is no it's all equality, no matter what. But we often don't experience it on the absolute side. So the absolute experience is a physical experience first. And that's why Zazen itself is our practice, which is a most physical experience. We always forget that. It always seems like a head thing, but it's not. It's to sit down and be what this is. And what this is an embodiment on the earth. So it's true. Our truth is in our body, as our body lives. It is the truth, our truth. A truth. It's a really important point, because often we wonder how we know what's the right thing to do, but our body always knows. And I find as I get older and start losing things more, that my body always knows where things are. If I stop running around and trying to figure it out, I just go right to where it is. It's in us. It is us. Thank you. Chewy?
Bodies are different, though. They're not. I'm not sure if we even have our... I think that's an important point, though. I get the impression that we think of body... when thinking of body as absolute, that there's just... that we all... that this body, because we share the same kind of body, we all experience things.
In the same way that...
I'm not so sure that that's...
It doesn't say that. There are many, many... Everyone has a different experience. Every leaf on the tree is its own self. So, and maybe we really don't know whether your experience of the color red is the same as Samyutt's. There's no way to tell.
There's this, like, human activity which tries to... in this search for commonality, finding the right thing to do, we may think a certain body is fitter in a certain case than another.
That's the point. That's the point of this. Yes.
So it is this precept saying that that activity is not necessary at all?
It's saying that if you if you dwell on it, Bodhidharma says, if that's the point you're making over and over again, then you're just expressing your own instability. And that there is a point in the mind of equanimity, a still point, where everything is as different as everything is, everything belongs together.
The Sendokai.
Yes, Sendokai, like the Sendokai, exactly.
He talks about that.
Yeah.
The problem is thinking the whole, sometimes even being weak can be better.
Yes.
In a way.
Yes.
Being strong.
Yep.
So it's important to be both.
Or to see how we are both. You know, we make up stories about what we are like, but if we really pay attention, we see that we're both of those, where we got all of it in us. And none of this is saying we should polish ourselves up and never be, you know, blaming or dwelling on past mistakes or stealing or any of those things. That isn't the point of this. It's just to awaken us to what's going on moment by moment.
First of all cats are snooty.
Oh, well, that's true. This is a particularly snooty cat.
the thing that's struck me about what you've been saying is how much the stories that I've had. How much all of my life I felt this need to grasp onto the things that I'm good at or that I think are good in order to elevate myself.
Mm-hmm.
Just as you said, to feel a certain sense of equality or to feel that I belong.
Yeah.
And it's kind of it's ridiculous to a certain extent, or I guess it is ridiculous.
It's natural.
And I don't know how else to say it. I'm not really sure how to get rid of the anxiety and to just accept that I'm just as anybody else. With whatever inequities and defaults and our strengths, and just to accept that, I'll keep this person just the same as anybody else.
One way is to not worry about yourself, but to study others more carefully. Instead of assuming you know who they are and where they stand, and try to find out who they really are and where they stand.
That's right. I mean, you're stuck in that anxiety and trying to protect yourself, then you lose the focus of everybody else.
Yeah. Yes. And more protective because you feel more and more apart from everyone. Exactly. Thank you. We grow up with our conditioning. You know, we've been given a lot of it through what happened to us all through our life. And we wake up, you know, on the cushion and begin to realize how much of our life and our story and our experience has been telling us who we are and who other people are without our actually having made up our mind about it ourselves. So that's why this is such an interesting practice, because we get a chance to really begin to look at our conditioning. Where did this idea come from? Where did that idea come from? And sometimes they turn out to be accurate, and sometimes they're way off.
I'm not sure I understood Francois's point. Is it, for an example, like your talents, perhaps cooking, that you don't kind of use it to praise ourselves that, you know, I am good at cooking, so therefore I'm going to, you know, make a 7-layer cake and then it will flop at one point and my ego's just going to go with it.
Exactly it.
So if that's correct, could we... To me, I feel that talent is a gift, and to work with it and be thankful for it. It's like somebody comes and gives you a gift. What's your first reaction? I think, thank you. Mm. And to appreciate it and be with it. And it will, I think it will elevate you, and you wouldn't need to do anything else. But I'm talking from experience, because I love to cook too, and if things aren't perfect, it's like here, I explain how this was supposed to be, but it doesn't, and it was so much better last time, and on and on. And when I try not to care so much, it really is so much better.
I feel what you're saying. It's there comes a time, and maybe I'll just talk about myself, where there's that line where it's not so much a it's doing it for a validation of self, more than just the artistry of it, or the sheer joy of doing it, and I use a more solid example. For me, sometimes when I'm in a group of people who I think are highly educated and extraordinary at what they do, then I'll use my card of I'm a great cook. And I do that. And it's too in that group of feeling not being an equal, or feeling not measuring up, that I'll come up with something that I am good at and play it up, praising myself. To be acceptable in the group. That has its bad features.
So
But I'm still saying, if you take that and stay with it,
I
may,
right? You're right.
And just that's your gift. And you play that card, you know? And, you know, in a balanced way.
Yes.
That's what I do, and I'm proud of that gift, maybe without saying it. Because that's who we are, right?
Well, that's part of what... Humbly, yes. But if we use it to protect ourselves from other people. And that's what I'm hearing, that it's protecting ourselves from really knowing other people, but just trying to live up to some kind of high standard that is imagined in others. Because actually, usually it's not even the case. You know, making those assumptions is already a form of suffering. Oh, that person is a whole lot better than I am, so I'd better be a whole lot better, and see, here I am, you know, and you can make up a whole painful situation. But of course, if you're really good at something, it's wonderful to enjoy it, you know, and be proud of it. That kind of pride is a different kind of pride.
It seems that going into a room full of talented, wonderful people and not being worried about do I fit in or not fit in, I just have to go. And it's a joy to get together and have people enjoy it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because that's the truth. That's the real truth of it. You're a really good cook. What a wonderful thing. So, raise your hand if you think Francois is a good cook.
First of all, I just want one response. Every room is full of wonderful and talented people. Can you look closer?
Yes.
Yep.
And I just wanted to flip it around because I believe it's also can happen the other way, in a problematic way. And that's what. And I don't know. I do believe it's partly gender, but of always putting yourself down to fit in, and thinking if I really talk about what I'm good at, people will. Not like me.
Mm.
So I think that's what I've been doing. So I'm kind of working the opposite way. So. Yeah, and it's kind of fun. It's like I've been like putting myself down for so long and then kind of like rising up, and then there's all this. And then you do, it's exactly what you're saying about it's connecting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you connect with other people and what they're good at. And
yes.
And then it's more positivity than negativity or like what we're talking about, competition.
It's more fun. Yeah.
I like to dance, and I've been dancing more in the office story than that. But I went dancing the other night, and I just like to have fun. And people like that. I like to have lots of rules and stuff, but I just like to have fun. And then I was dancing with someone. I was like, I just like to dance. That's good. That's, you should just be having fun. He's like, you should be, we should be dancing like no one's watching us. And I'm like, no, actually, in my new way of looking at it, I want to be dancing like people are watching. And kind of like, because who wants to watch someone who's like not having fun? So it kind of, you know, connects and kind of just be out there, I guess.
And enter the stream of it, you know, that's really what it is. It's a huge streaming energies of everyone. And if we hold ourselves too much back, we miss our life, actually. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Francois. Wow. What a life. Well, it's 8 o'clock, it's a little after 8 o'clock, and we have another thing on the agenda tonight, and that is a happening in the back room that I hope you all are prepared to stay, and make something happy of a very sad event of our Jane going to what set Toronto on fire. Do some great thing for Canada. Anyway, it's a party. And so we should stop now and get ready to enjoy.